right, so once you've done those three, then we give you a new specification altogether for a trio of problems called sentiments. And essentially, you will implement three programs or complete the implementation thereof of smile, whereby smile takes a command line argument where you can type in a word like love, and if that's a positive word, you should see a green happy face. If you type in a seemingly negative word like hate, you should see a red unhappy face. If you type in a word like Stanford, you should see a neutral or yellow face like this. And how is this actually working? Well, inspired by our recent look at machine learning, we will have you manipulate two big text files that come from faculty whose research is in the world of sentiment analysis or opinion mining, which generally refers to the analysis of text to infer opinion. So looking at like Amazon reviews or Rotten Tomato reviews or in our case tweets and trying to infer with high probability whether someone is happy or sad or angry or delighted or in this case just generally positive or negative. And so the two of the files that we give you for this problem set are called positivewords.txt and negativewords.txt. And if we go ahead and open these among the distribution code that you'll download, you will see, not unlike problem set 5's dictionary, just a whole lot of words that are alphabetically here. So bonuses is positive, bountiful is positive, brainiest, brand new. So some of these might be a little questionable, but in general, academics have decided that in general these imply positivity. Meanwhile, if we go to negative words, after some comments, two-faced and two faces and abnormal and abominable and abrasive and abrupt and any number of other words, A through Z. What's kind of tragic is that I think there's about 2,000 positive words and 4,000 negative things to say. So it's heavily skewed toward negativity. But what you'll ultimately be able to do is this, and we've already installed the staff solutions. You can go ahead and run tilde CS50, PSET 6, smile. And someone want to propose a word? Tomato, neutral, something else? Muppet 50, all right, pretty sure that's not in the dictionary. Something else? Yale. We should have added that to one of the files, shouldn't we? But they're watching. Nope, neutral, just for good measure. We love everyone equally. Any positive or negative words come to mind? How about love? How about hate? And we give you some other suggestions in the specification. Okay, so that's what smile does. It just takes a single command line argument, but let's tease you with what else you're going to do. You're also gonna run a program called tweets that's going to look like this, tilde CS50, PSET 6, tweets. And if you run this, you're gonna see that you're prompted by default for a screen name. So if we actually run this on CS50's screen name on Twitter, let me go ahead and do that. And you will see line by line all of the tweets that CS50 has posted, whereby a zero means overall it's neutral, one over or positive overall means that it's a positive thing to say. And I was relieved to see when working this out, CS50 has never said a negative thing, it seems, or at least among our past 50 tweets. By contrast, if we do something like, I'll go there. Oh my goodness. Okay, but it's actually not as red as you might expect, but you'll see a combination here of yellow and red and green, and all of these are tweets that he posted within the past 50 tweets, and if we do his opponents, you'll see, we've been playing with this. They tweet pretty frequently, so it keeps changing. Hillary had a string of negativity recently. But this is ultimately what you're going to make here. And then finally, let's tease you with one final problem. Let me go ahead and run in the sentiments directory that you will download. I'm going to go ahead and run a command that we'll come back to. Host equals this address, this IP, port equals this, run. And what you'll see is that you'll ultimately get a website that looks like this, with a very simple HTML form, and if we type in something like CS50 and click search, it's not gonna work yet, your code will ultimately generate on the World Wide Web a chart like this that currently is just hard-coded saying everything in the world is neutral, but eventually you'll see pie slices that are green and red representing positivity and negativity as well after analyzing a corpus of 100 of a person's tweets. So let's take a tour now of exactly what you need to do and what questions might arise along the way. So first, let me go ahead and draw your attention to the specification here. And what you should absolutely do after this walkthrough and before you really dive in is walk yourself through the understanding section of the problem set. And we will walk you through all of the files and what you should take away from each of those. And we'll do something similar in spirit here. I'm going to go ahead and open up the file called Smile, and this is a program we have written in its entirety for you. You'll notice that it's not very user-friendly or very highlighted right now, and that's because if you look in the bottom right-hand corner, CS50 IDE doesn't know what language this program is written in because it's just called Tweets. It's not called tweets.c or .py, but you can override that. Since we know it's written in Python, we can change that to Python, and now it just is a little more pleasurable to look at. And let me go back and zoom in for today's sake. So let's take a look at what's going on inside of Tweets. At the top of this file is a so-called shebang, and that's how the IDE knows how to run it, even though it has no file extension. Import sys, what is the equivalent in C of import? Yeah, so it's like hash include in C. The syntax is a little different, but this is including, as we'll see, a sys module that's built into Python that has some useful functionality, among them command line arguments. This is slightly different syntax, but it does something very similar in spirit. And what's nice about Python is that it tends, in many cases, to read a little more intuitively, more like English sentences, even though it's still pretty terse. So from analyzer, import something called analyzer with a capital A, and from term color, import colored. So it turns out that these two are modules. There's a module in our current directory called analyzer that we're going to look at in a moment, and then Python comes with a module that someone else wrote that you will pre-install for yourselves per the specifications instructions called term color for terminal color, and that's going to allow us to print green and red and yellow a lot more easily. Meanwhile, we have main down here, and we didn't see that before. So let me rewind for just a moment and go back into our hello example from earlier, which looked like this. And let me go ahead and tell CS50 IDE that this is indeed Python. I don't have a main method here, a main function here, but that's because Python does not require, and frankly, it doesn't really know about main functions. That's really going to be a human convention now. But it turns out that I could rewrite this program as follows. I could define a function called main and then indent that code underneath it. But if I do that, notice what happens. If I open up my terminal window now and do .hello, enter, nothing's happening anymore. Well, wait a minute. Maybe let me undo what I did. Maybe I'm just not understanding. Let me go ahead and undo and rerun it. Okay, that works, but if I put in main, it doesn't work. And this is a bit of a curiosity, but you might recall, or you will see in problems in week 8's lecture, a very typical paradigm here is to do this. If name equals equals underscore underscore main, then call main. So it's a little cryptic. It's unfortunate that it looks as ugly as it does, but essentially this line of code here on line 6 is saying if the name of this file, not the file name, but if like the symbol that describes this file is called main with two underscores on the left and the right, go ahead and call this function. And it turns out the way this is working is as follows. When you run a program at the command line, either like this with a shebang, or if we simply did Python of hello, Python's interpreter is going to assign this special variable, underscore, underscore, name, underscore, underscore, a special value of underscore, underscore, main, underscore, underscore, so that you know in a program that might contain several Python files, which of them was the entry point, which was the one that the user specified at the command prompt. So long story short, these two lines of code allow us to recreate the requirement in C that functions have a main function, but it's not strictly necessary in Python. But it's going to allow us to do things, as you'll see in week 8, like define other functions without having to put prototypes at the top of the file. So this is all a long way of saying this is why we now have a main function inside of Tweets, just so that we can organize things a little more like we did in C. But notice that some of the syntax has changed. On line 11, you can see ensure proper usage. But can someone translate this into slightly more technical terms? What are lines 11 and 12 doing? Yeah.
If there are two command line arguments, exit the program.
Exactly. If there are not two command line arguments, go ahead and exit the program and print out this message. So new syntax. We've not seen sys.exit before. We haven't seen len before. Sys.argv is a little different. And indeed, it's not even mentioned in main's parentheses. That's because argv, simply by design of Python, is accessible inside of this so-called module, this library, called sys. So it's just different, is all. But the end result is just to make sure that the user definitely executes the program with two command line arguments. But recall, if I'm going to ultimately run this as follows, if I'm going to do dot slash smile of at CS, or rather of love, argv is going to contain two arguments there, just like in C, dot slash smile and love. If, however, the file were called smile.py, that's fine too. I could do this and still say love. And the way this kind of invocation is going to work is argv is still going to contain only two words. Python will not be inside of argv. So realize you don't have to worry about that particular detail if you start renaming files, which you shouldn't need to do for the problem set itself. So what happens next? After I ensure that I have the right number of command line arguments, this is new syntax in Python. On line 15, I'm instantiating an analyzer. So we're going to see in a moment that an analyzer is just like a structure, a data structure that we, CS50 staff, have written for you, whose purpose in life is to analyze a word and say 1, this is positive, negative 1, this is negative, or 0, or some bigger positive or bigger negative number. But the syntax here just means this. On the left-hand side, give me a variable called analyzer. On the right-hand side, instantiate a new analyzer object. So you can think of the right-hand side here of being very similar in spirit to malloc. But it's a little fancier in that it's giving you not just a chunk of memory, it is giving you a structure, aka an object, of type analyzer. More on that in just a moment. Now, if I scroll down further, this program doesn't do all that much. In fact, we're almost done. Smile does the following. It looks at that structure, otherwise known as an object, and it calls a function called analyze that's inside of it. And this is where Python is especially different from C. C structures only have values inside of them, strings or ints or floats, though technically you can have something called a function pointer, but generally it's not done. Whereas Python, when you have a structure, otherwise known as an object, it can have data inside of it as well as functions. And whenever a function is inside of an object in Python or other languages, we just call it a method. But it's the same thing. It's just a synonym. So this is passing to a function called analyze that's inside of this analyzer object whatever the word the user typed in. So sys.argv bracket 1 is very similar in spirit to C. It's just passing in love. It's passing in hate or whatever the user typed at the command line. And now notice, thankfully, this is a little more C and even scratch-like in some sense. If the score that comes back from the analyzer is greater than 0, print out a green smiley face. If the score is less than 0.0, print out a red unhappy face. Otherwise, print out this yellow ambivalent face. But what's different here? Perhaps just point out the obvious. Lines 19 to 24, what's different versus C? Yeah. So there's no parentheses. And there could be, but minimalism is generally a guiding light with a language like Python. We could do this if it helps you read it, but it's not necessary, so why would you bother, is kind of the spirit of things. You can add them, though, if it helps logically, if you had multiple conditions, but we don't have that here. What else is different versus C? Yeah, so elif is just kind of a more succinct way of saying else if, and indeed you should not say else if, you must say elif in this case here, unless you really nest things, but it's going to get ugly if you do that. What else is different versus C? Yeah. Oh, let's go over here first. Yes, so colon, we had a colon at the end of the line, and this is necessary. So this will be your new semicolon, if you will. It's not quite a semicolon, now it's just a colon, but this is necessary, but what is not necessary in Python is curly braces. Indeed, even if there were multiple statements here and here, all that Python requires is that your code be consistently indented. So all of you who have been kind of playing loose with style in writing your programs and maybe cleaning it up at the very last minute, those days are over. Whether or not you use style 50 in the past, which won't work for Python, it's only going to work for C, the Python interpreter will not execute your code if you perhaps are one of those people that have maybe been writing code that looks like this, and then maybe this is over here sometimes, and this is over here, and this is over here, and then eventually you promise in office hours that you'll clean it up later, like, it's just not going to work anymore. So this is a good thing and a bad thing, depending on sort of one's personal preference, but it is necessary in Python that everything be consistently indented. Sorry, I probably shouldn't go off on that rant. All right, so what remains for you to do? Smile is written for you, but analyzer.py is not. And here are your first to-dos. So you will see in this file only 16 lines in the editor here, but most of them are just placeholders. So at the top of this file, we're including something called the Natural Language Toolkit. It turns out that this problem set could be pretty tedious if given a tweet, you, as in C, might have to iterate over all of the characters, figuring out what's alphabetical, what's punctuation, what's a space, because if you want to analyze ultimately all of the words in Donald Trump's tweets, or all of the words in Hillary Clinton's tweets, or CS50s, or anyone else's, it's just going to be annoying and tedious to have to parse those strings and break them up into individual words. So one of the things you get with languages like Python and higher level languages more generally is a lot of functionality for free, so to speak, just by using someone else's library. So the Natural Language Toolkit that the spec will show you how to install is going to give you, among other things, a tokenizer whose purpose in life is to tokenize strings. Take a string that looks like it has individual words, and indeed it does, but break it up into a list or an array of individual strings that you can then analyze. No, I don't know why that design decision was made. It is indeed requisite. It doesn't have to be called self, but the calling convention for Python is indeed that the interpreter will pass, or the runtime will pass in a reference to that object, to the every one of the object's functions. But I would have to read up to know why. But it is necessary, unlike Java or other languages. All right. If not familiar with that, not to worry just yet. So what do we have here? Whereas in C, we saw the keyword struct, and we often used it with the keyword typedef. In Python, if you want a structure that I'm now going to start calling a class to be accurate, you simply say class analyzer, and then for now we're just going to have open paren, close paren. But it turns out there's the notion in programming of inheritance, and we won't spend much time on this in CS50, but you would in higher level courses if you take them thereafter. You can actually have a hierarchy of classes, a hierarchy of structs that depend on each other, but for now we're just going to have open paren, close paren, colon. This is a weird looking comment called a doc string, so Python adopted the convention of documenting its functions and classes not above them, as we did in C, but immediately inside of them. So you're going to see a convention like this whereby quote, 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 contains multi-line comments that by convention should go at the very top. But don't get too distracted with those kinds of details yet. This is a little more interesting. On line 6, we have a method, a function, but it's inside of a class, so we call it a method, called underscore underscore init underscore underscore. And indeed, the convention here is going to be anytime you see methods that, or symbols more generally, that start with underscore underscore, they're generally special symbols that are often come with the language itself or prescribed by the language itself. You must, for now, put self as the first argument to any such method in a class, but more on that in the future. And then what's nice about Python is that it doesn't have just positional arguments, whereby you can pass in 0 or 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 arguments to a function. It has what are called named arguments. And you kind of see this here in that I'm giving these names default values. If you, the caller, don't tell my analyzer class what positives value should be or what negatives value should be, I am going to assume you want these two text files names by default, which is a handy feature. Moreover, what's cool about Python is as soon as you have parameters that have names, you can pass in arguments in different orders if you want. It's not necessarily good practice, but the fact that Python supports names, as is super clear here, you'll see in online references, you can actually pass things in by parameter name, and we'll see that in a moment, I believe. Lastly, there's one other function here that you have to implement, or a method called analyze, that again just has to take a reference to self, and text is going to be the tweet or the string or whatever is that's passed in. So how is self useful? Back in the day, whenever you had a variable, you would simply do something like n gets, or in C, you would say something like int n equals 42 semicolon. And that variable would be local to a function, and therefore it would disappear after that function returns. That's our whole discussion of scope back in the day. But it turns out in Python, now that we have classes, which are like blueprints or molds out of which come objects, so to speak, you can actually do something like this. again, no semicolon, that means the following. When a caller, like the Smile program, creates or instantiates an analyzer object, this method in it is automatically called, just because. That's how Python works. This line here, temporarily, is storing in an instance variable called n, the number 42, just because. This is useless, don't do this in the actual program. But it's demonstrating how I could store inside of this structure any variable, any data that I want, and it's going to persist even after init returns. And what this means is that if you think back to problem set 5, when you implemented probably a linked list or an array or a hash table or a try, where did you store the pointer to that data structure? Think back to your own implementation. Where was it? Yeah. Exactly. You stored it as a global variable outside of check, outside of load, outside of unload, outside of size, so that all four of those functions could somehow access it. This is not good design. C is an older language, and it lacked features to make this super easy, but it turns out that with Python, and with some effort with C, you can actually store variables inside of structures, as well as associate methods or functions with those structures, so that in the case of problem set 5, if we implemented the dictionary in some other language like Python, which we did do in week 8's lecture, you can, so to speak, encapsulate all of the words you loaded, all 140,000 words inside of the structure itself, and this would actually allow you to have in a program multiple dictionaries, and it would allow you to avoid having to declare anything as global. So this is just a very long way of saying you are probably going to want to store something in self, and that something is probably going to be the words that you are loading from those two text files. This is, in some sense, your load function from problem set 5. Meanwhile, the analyze function is going to be similar to the check function from problem set 5. It's going to have to search those words that you've loaded into memory somehow and actually do something with them. And you might want to look back at week 8's example where we introduced a student class, which, while super simple, gives you a hint as to how you can do this. All right, any questions on analyzer.py? All right, so that's problem 1 of 1. Tweets, thankfully, uses the same analyzer, but not yet. This is all you get for tweets. So let's consider for just a moment what tweets is going to have to do. I ran it a moment ago, and you write dot slash tweets and then a screen name, like at CS50 or at someone else. That's going to be in sys.argv. What do you then need to do? You're going to need to query Twitter for the past 50 of that user's tweets, which is going to give you back, hopefully, a list of strings. And then you're going to want to pass each of those strings to what function, probably? To what method? Analyzer.analyze. So it's going to be, tweets is very similar in spirit to Smile. It just has to do something else, which is talk to Twitter. Thankfully, in a file called helpers.py, we give you a function, or method called, or rather, we give you a function called getUserTimeline. And we've named it, identical to what Twitter calls this same functionality. It takes two arguments, screen name, and then count, which is going to have a default value of 200, but the spec will tell you to request 50, for instance, at a time. And let's see how this works. If the count that's been passed in is less than 1 or greater than 200, raise. This is like a special exit message. This is going to make the program abort in the middle of execution, saying, something has gone wrong. So it's going to emit a runtime error that says invalid count. Meanwhile, this is something we discuss in the specification. Twitter requires that you have what's called an API key and an API secret. Long story short, this is super common in industry. When you're going to use someone else's data set, they generally want to either know who you are or track how many times you're using their service so that, in particular, they can rate limit you so that you're not hitting them a million times per second, thereby keeping out other customers. They want to limit you to maybe a query per second or 100 queries per second. And indeed, the reason why in problem set 6 you have to sign up for Twitter is that you need to be able to talk to their service for free, but they're only going to let you do it so many times per second or so many times per minute. So these lines of code that we give you just ensure that per the specification, you have indeed configured your IDE for that API key. And these last lines of code, we don't have to dwell on here since they're given to you, but these several lines of code at the bottom of helpers.py, long story short, make an HTTP request to twitter.com, passing in the screen name that the user has typed if you pass it to this helper function, and it returns to you a Python list, similar in spirit to an array, of that user's past 50 tweets or past 200 tweets, however many you request. So what's nice is that this function, if you call it in your tweets program, it's going to hand you back a list containing as many tweets as you asked for, at which point you can probably iterate over those tweets, pass them into that analyzer and that analyze method, and then print them out in red or yellow or green so that, again, the end result, if we run the staff solution, which behaves ultimately the same, gives you output that looks a little something like that, the past 50 tweets with the score prepended at the beginning. Then this looks better when it's in a smaller font on a bigger screen. All right, any questions on tweets? All right, the third, yeah? Correct. Good question. So in my program itself, like Smile, I used sys.exit when I detected something has gone wrong. The user has not cooperated by providing me with the command line arguments I wanted, for instance. And so I am going to proactively just exit the program with this kind of message. By contrast, this helper function, we have documented in the form of its comments, we haven't documented as thoroughly as the comments suggest, that the maximum number, or rather, have we done this? So in fairness, we should probably document more in green that there is this constraint. But essentially here, it would be presumptuous if someone's library code, which helpers.py effectively is, just aborted my whole program. So in the world of Python and other languages, what a helper function would typically do, as in this case here, is not presumptuously kill your whole program, because that would really tick you off, probably. If you're the programmer, you call some library, and damn it, it quit my whole program on me. Like, that just doesn't feel right. It should inform you if there's an error, but your main function, really, your entry point, your main file, it should decide when and if your program is indeed going to exit. So what raise does, and this is not a feature that C has, this raises or throws an exception. This is a special type of error that essentially bubbles back up through the stack or bubbles down through the stack back to that original caller, main in this case. And it turns out, long story short, if I were in Smile to care about this, I should have done this. This method here could raise what's called an exception. If I really want to be proper, I should do this and then decide what to do if error. We don't expect this. We haven't introduced this in CS50, but this is the mechanism that allows another function like analyze, or in my case helpers, to notice if something went wrong and then handle that exception, so to speak. And I just realized I wrapped the wrong function. I meant to wrap the get user timeline function, but the idea is the same here. But don't worry about that just yet, more generally. OK, yeah. Correct. So this means actually write some code there. Otherwise, you're going to have to say that. Pass. Just a demonstration. Other questions? Yeah?
When we use the getUser timeline function, we have to import helpers.c somewhere?
Really good question. When you use getUser timeline, do you have to import helper somewhere? Yes, you do. And let me simply leave that as an exercise to be figured out. Not hard, but draw inspiration, for instance, from how we're doing it in Smile or in some of our lecture examples. Good question. Other questions? All right, so let's look at the third and final and perhaps prettiest version of what we're doing. So inside of the sentiments directory that you download per the specification, you actually get a whole bunch of files, not just Smile and tweets and positive words and negative words and helpers. You also, and analyzer.py, you also get application.py, and a directory called templates. This is, if you look back at week 8's lecture, or when you do, is a web-based application using a framework that is a big library called Flask. If I open up application.py, you'll see relatively little code here as follows. At the top, and we did this in lecture briefly, we just import or include a whole bunch of features of the Flask library. And we'll see more of this with Problem Set 7 and upcoming lectures. I'm importing, oh, spoiler, who was it that asked? Okay, so there you go. So yes, you'll have to import helpers in a manner similar to this. And then from Analyzer, I'm importing specifically that class. This line here is just per Flask's own documentation, how you create a Flask application. That is how you make a website that uses this software called Flask. Down here now is the interesting part. On line 8 and line 12, I declare what are called routes. Routes are paths in my HTTP request that I care about. So slash tends to be the default route in most websites. So that means this is like the default request handler. And then slash search, if you think back from lecture 6, when we introduced HTTP and I whipped up that simple Google example, Google uses slash search, so that's a route as well. So notice the index route, the default, doesn't do anything intellectually interesting, it just renders a template. It spits out an HTML file called index.html. Search is a little more interesting in that it does the following. It validates the screen name, so this is the syntax when using Flask for checking not command line arguments, which are not relevant to web-based applications, but checking the HTTP parameter called screen name. If it exists, if it does not exist, then I'm gonna go ahead and redirect the user to index, which is slash. Otherwise, I'm gonna go ahead and call helpers.getUserTimeline, so here's another hint for tweets, passing in the screen name. Here is something interesting, and unfortunately this is to do. The reason why that chart was entirely yellow 100% earlier is because in our distribution code, we hard-coded a value of 0 for positive, 0 for negative, and 100 for neutral. And this is a trick in Python that C does not have. If you want to initialize multiple variables simultaneously, all with a single equal sign, you can actually do this. Technically in Python, you're declaring on the left what's called a tuple, and on the right, a tuple, each of whose elements are respectively assigned from right to left. So it's just a sexy one-liner instead of having to do this in three separate lines as you might in C. So scrolling down below, we generate a chart, and this is a function we give you also in helpers.py, passing in positive, negative, and neutral values. This gives you back literally a chunk of HTML. So we have implemented all of the functionality via which you can generate a chart, and we just hand you back the HTML provided you hand us the appropriate percentages or values. And then lastly, and this is where things are a little more interesting, we call render template again, spitting out search.html instead of index.html. But what's nice about Flask and frameworks like it, we can pass into our templates values. So we don't have to spit out only pre-written HTML. We can instead spit out a web page that also contains this HTML for the chart and also contains the user's screen name. How? Well, let's take a look. Let me go back into what this window looked like and notice that not only is the route slash search, question mark screen name equals CS50, so think back to week 6's lecture where we talked about HTTP and how the web works. That's very similar in spirit to that discussion. Notice that at CS50 is displayed in the HTML itself, and then clearly the chart is embedded in the page itself. So where did that come from? Well, if we go into that templates directory, notice that we have a few files. Index, or rather, let's do layout.html, which is just the overarching layout, so to speak, the framework for this website, including the head tag, the body tag, some divs inside. But notice this, an HTML tag called small. This looks completely cryptic. This is not Python per se, it's not HTML per se, this is Jinja, a templating language. This is just saying plug in the value of subtext here, whatever that is, and we'll see that in just a moment. Plug in the body of the web page here. So these things with curly braces and percent signs are part of a templating language that is yet another language to learn, but it's not one of the intellectually interesting ones. These things are a dime a dozen, but this one's very popular. It's just used to plug in values into files. So for instance, when I'm on that search page, this is all I had to write in search.html. It doesn't even look like HTML, but notice what it's saying. Hey, server, this file, search.html, extends layout.html. So it sort of inherits from it, if you will, like a descendant. And then, hey, web server, here is my subtext block. The only thing I want in there is literally an at sign. And then curly brace, variable name, curly brace, refers back to whatever I passed in to my render template method. So there is that screen name. Where am I putting the chart? Well, hey server, here's the body of my web page. Go ahead and spit out the chart. And this is what's called a filter, which says, hey server, I know this is HTML that someone else created, but I'm promising that it is safe. You don't have to go in and escape it and turn certain dangerous characters like open bracket into ampersand LT semicolon, which long story short, there are certain characters in HTML that could break a web page because they look like the start of tags. So this is just saying, hey server, spit out the chart that CS50's function gave me and don't worry about any of those issues. But you don't have to write any of this just yet. In problem set 7 in the final project, quite likely will you want to play with these things, but for now we give you this framework. Any questions? All right, and just to make clear that this is actually doing as I claim, let me go into pset 6, sentiments, let me rerun that flask command, let me go back here, and why don't we analyze Harvard's tweets. So if I type in at Harvard and click search, oh, of course, it doesn't work. Damn it, I forgot. This is not the staff solution. So we don't know, cliffhanger, don't know what Harvard's tweets are going to look like. We don't know what Yale's tweets are going to look like. But you'll see here that if I wanted to say something more in here, I could say hello and then plug in actual text into search.html. And I clearly have an aesthetic bug that I'll need to go in and fix. But that's how I'm updating the template. The rest is being given to you. All right. Any questions then on sentiments? All right, so for overarching advice, let me propose this. Because there's those several problems in the beginning where you port programs from C to Python, dive into those this week as soon as you can. Take advantage of doing that on your own time if you can, wrestling with any of the syntax that's new to you, Googling as needed, asking on CS50 Discuss, so that really you focus the most of your time potentially on sentiments, taking advantage of office hours on Wednesday or Thursday or Sunday or anywhere in between at HSA or wherever on campus so that you have ample support and feel like you're arriving really ready to dive into the meat of the problem as opposed to just those syntactic warm-ups. All right, let's officially adjourn here, and I'll stick around for one-on-one questions.